听力课堂，听 class.com。
Passage 2. Culture is one of the most challenging elements of the international marketplace. This system of learned behavior patterns characteristic of the members of a given society is constantly shaped by a number of dynamic factors. Language, religion, values and attitudes, manners and customs, aesthetics, technology, education, and social institutions. To cope with this system, an international manager needs both factual and interpretive knowledge of culture. To some extent, this factual knowledge can be learned. Its interpretation comes only through experience. The most complicated problems in dealing with the cultural environmentcome from the fact that one cannot learn culture. One has to live it. Two schools of thought exist in business the world around, following the model of Pepsi and McDonald's. In some cases, globalization is a fact of life. However, cultural differences are still widening. The other school proposes that companies must take individual cultures as their business approaches.Setting up policies and procedures in each country has been compared to an organ transplant. The critical question centers around acceptance or rejection. The major challenge to the international manager is to make sure that rejection is not a result of cultural short-sightedness or blindness. The Fortune magazine examined the international performance of a dozen large companiesthat earn 20% or more of their revenue overseas. The internationally successful companies all share an important quality: patience. They have not rushed into situations, but rather built their operations carefully by following the most basic business principles. These principles are to know your competitor, know your audience, and know your customer.
Passage 3.Successful international marketing does not stop with good translation. Other aspects of culture must be researched and understood if marketers are to avoid errors and capture their target. For example, when a popular American designer tried to introduce a new perfume in the Latin American market, the product aroused little interest and the company lost a lot of money. Advertisements for the new perfumehighlighted its fresh camellia scent. What marketers had failed to realize was that camellias are traditionally used for funerals in many South American countries. P&G has been successful in marketing its products internationally for many years. Today, overseas markets account for over one-third of its sales. However, the company's success in this area did not happen overnight.P&G initially experienced huge losses because marketing managers did not recognize important cultural differences. For instance, when P&G first entered the Japanese market with its popular Cheer laundry detergent, most Japanese housewives weren't interested. The promotional campaign that emphasized Cheer as an effective all-temperature detergent was lost on the Japanese,who usually wash clothes in cold water. Though the ad had been quite successful in the United States, where clothes are washed in all temperatures, it fell flat in Japan. All of this could have been avoided if P&G marketers had done more preliminary research before launching the campaign. Once P&G changed its strategy and promised superior cleaning in cold water, sales for Cheer picked up dramatically.The use of numbers can also be a source of problems for international marketers. Since every culture has its own set of lucky and unlucky numbers, companies need to do their homework if they want to avoid marketing errors. A U.S. manufacturer of golf balls learned this lesson when it packaged its products in groups of four for export to Japan. The company couldn't figure out why the golf balls weren't selling well,until it realized that in Japan, the word for the number four also means death. In Japan, 4 and 9 are very unlucky numbers, which should be avoided by marketers. Part 4. Service is viewed by people in Japan not as a luxury, but as an essential ingredient for the success of individual companies and the Japanese economy as a whole. Americans who move to Japan never get used to the range of service and courtesies taken for granted here. To those old enough to remember how things used to be at home, life can bring on twinges of nostalgia. Supermarket checkout counters have two or three people ring up and bagging groceries. Some stores deliver, with each bag arriving neatly stapled closed. Dry ice is inserted alongside the frozen foods to ensure that they don't spoil on the way. Television shops normally send a technician to install and fine-tune a newly purchased set. The technician will run back if anything goes wrong. Car salespeople are known to bring new models around to customers' homes for test drives, and loaners are available for people whose cars are in for repairs. There are no limits to what is home delivered. Video movies, dry cleaning, health foods, office deliveries are common too, especially of lunch. Japanese barbers often give back massages as part of an ordinary haircut. If they remove a customer's eyeglasses, they may polish the lenses before returning them. Self-service gasoline has yet to make its appearance here in any significant way. At the minimum, attendants fill the tank and wipe the windshield. They often empty ashtrays and stop traffic to let the motorist back on the road. Department stores seem to have twice, if not three times, the floor staff of American ones. Many stores wrap everything they sell. Upscale customers don't have to come in at all. The goods are taken to their homes for display and selection. Feudal Japan evolved tight rituals of personal service. Many survive in the traditional inns. Proprietors bow when guests arrive and straighten the shoes they step out of. Welcoming tea and elaborate meals are brought to the rooms. Bedding is laid out and cleared away in the morning. On departure, the bows may be held until a guest's car is out of sight. But even in modern businesses, the culture's attention to detail and doing things the correct way fit well into the service mentality. While Americans may find it demeaning to fuss over a customer, Japanese worry, with reason, that their shop will be laughed at if they don't. Perhaps the darkest spot on personal service in Japan is how remarkably impersonal it can be. Everyone is treated exactly alike. Employees' cheery greetings and directions, in fact, are often memorized from a company manual. After a month's stay in a hotel, guests may find the staff still has no idea who they are. Still, the Japanese view service as the glue that holds commercial relationships together. If the correct personal contact and follow-up come with the first sale, a second is sure to come. Market share and loyal customers are the first goal, not short-term profit. Service may cost, but it helps ensure these more important objectives. While Americans in need of something think of stores, Japanese often think of dealers, individuals who supply and advise over the years on product lines like sake, clothing, and electronic equipment. Memories of service may help a company weather hard times. If a computer firm drops behind in product quality or price, its customers will not abandon it altogether. They would feel treacherous doing so. After all, didn't the company send a technician to the office a dozen times to answer questions on that little desktop model? Expand that to national scale, and you have a more stable, predictable economy and job market in the Japanese view. Sample Test 1.
Part 1. A. Every day, Asian drivers are involved in serious accidents. Last year, 199 people were killed and 173 seriously injured on Singapore's roads. And in Malaysia, there were an average of 13 serious accidents and 14 road deaths every day from January to August 2003. Despite warnings from police and traffic safety officials, alcohol remains a major factor in many fatal accidents. You don't have to feel drunk to be drunk. Just a little alcohol can affect your ability to drive. If you want to drink, don't drive, says Lim Lu Ern, media relation officer with the Singapore Police Force. Indeed, long before you feel intoxicated, alcohol slows down your brain functions, altering your judgment and giving you false confidence. Alcohol also makes it hard to concentrate on more than one thing at a time. It reduces your ability to control your vehicle and to make assessments about distances or changing traffic lights, explains John Shah Mustafa, Superintendent of Public Relations of the Royal Malaysia Police. The safest blood alcohol level is zero. Taking any medication? Many prescription and over-the-counter medicines can cause drowsiness and dizziness, which can affect your driving, says David Wu, clinical pharmacist at Guardian Jalan Jelita in Singapore. The effect is multiplied if you drink even small amounts of alcohol at the same time or take two or more of these medicines at once. Sleeping tablets and tranquilizers are obvious culprits, but even common medicines like pain relievers, cold and flu preparations, blood pressure medication, and some hay fever treatments can slow your reactions. And if you take complementary medicines, remember that natural products can make you sleepy.
B. 1. After working on his car all morning, Dave took a break and headed for the beach. 2. After the windstorm, the rescue crew were working round the clock to restore power. 3. The highway was shut down for 4 hours due to a downed power pole. 4. Lately, the news from the forest industry hasn't been exactly upbeat. 5. The local citizens have been kept in the dark about plans for the new subdivision. 6. Many skiers just ignore the prominent signs that say, "Ski out of bounds at your own risk." 7. Clara found she could skip breakfast and get through morning classes just fine. 8. When Tom got home, he was still smarting from the comments the professor had made on his paper. 9. When they finally got the projections, Ellen's supervisor told her to take some time off. 10. Brown was ticketed under the Motor Vehicles Act after a fender bender in the mall parking lot.
Part 2. For the first time in history, two mobile robots are exploring the surface of another planet at the same time. Opportunity's twin, Spirit, started making wheel tracks halfway around Mars from Meridian on January 15th. We're two for two, one dozen wheels on the soil. JPL's Chris Lewicki, flight director, announced to the control room. Matt Wallace, mission manager at JPL, told a subsequent news briefing, "We knew it was going to be a good day. The rover woke up fit and healthy to Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run, and it turned out to be a good choice." The flight team needed only 7 days since Opportunity's landing to get the rover off its lander, compared with 12 days for Spirit earlier this month. "We're getting practice at it," said JPL's Joel Kadrewski, activity lead for the procedure. Also, the configuration of the deflated airbags and lander presented no trouble for Opportunity, while some of the extra time needed for Spirit was due to airbags at the front of the lander presenting a potential obstacle. Looking at a photo from Opportunity showing wheel tracks between the empty lander and the rear of the rover about 1 meter or 3 feet away, JPL's Kevin Burke, lead mechanical engineer for getting the rover off the lander, said, "We're glad to be seeing soil behind our rover."
Part 3, Passage 1. 18 crewmen, including 16 Filipinos, were reported dead as rescue workers abandoned their search for survivors after a cargo ship turned over in icy waters off the southwest coast of Norway. Just over 24 hours after the accident, 3 people were confirmed dead and 12 others rescued. But 15, including the ship's Norwegian captain, Jan Axel Juvik, were still missing at 4 p.m. on Tuesday, and rescue workers said they were launching a recovery operation. Rescue workers said many of the missing crew members, 13 Filipinos, 1 Norwegian and 1 German, may have been trapped inside the hull of the overturned ship, which was believed to have been filled with water since the accident. Silnes said divers had not been able to enter the ship because the vessel, loaded with a cargo of rubble, was not yet stable enough. The cause of the accident was still unknown, but Norwegian media reported that a collision with an underwater rock may have sliced open the Rocknes hull. A number of witnesses reported seeing a deep cut near the bottom of the ship. No sign of life has been detected inside the ship since 11:20 p.m. on Monday, when 7 hours after the vessel turned over, 3 Filipino survivors were pulled from the hull where they had been trapped.
Passage 2. One of the most profound effects of the Industrial Revolution, which developed rapidly in England during 1750 to 1850 and spread to the continent after the Napoleonic Wars, was to stimulate the growth of cities. Throughout Europe, only 17% of the population lived in cities in 1801. By 1851, the percentage increased to 35%, and by 1891, it was 54%. Growth accelerated and was most remarkable in England in the first half of the 19th century. An industrial midland involving the cities of Manchester, Birmingham, and Leeds grew in an area which, in the mid-18th century, was almost entirely rural. Meanwhile, the great cities of London, Paris, Vienna, Berlin, Rome, Madrid, and New York grew dramatically. The rate of growth was so rapid that city services could not keep pace. Cities were places where lack of sanitation, accumulation of sewage, high rates of disease, high rates of crime, and desperate poverty all existed. Heavy use of coal led to accumulations of dirt and grime. In the decade of the 1840s, city reformers like Chadwick saw the connection between the lack of sanitation and the prevalence of disease. It was the beginning of a public health movement which involved installation of sewage lines to wash out the worst of the pollution. The increased production of iron made it possible to manufacture the iron piping that was needed.
Passage 3. Many job seekers incorrectly view the tactic of networking as a mad quest to collect as many names as possible and then ask everyone on their list for jobs. No wonder introverts are afraid to network. This definition would exhaust any sensible person. Other job hunters define networking as asking for favors they can't return. "Networking makes me feel like I'm begging for a job," says a former human resources vice president at a New Jersey-based chemical company. In fact, both definitions are wrong. Networking shouldn't be mad, nor is it about begging for a job. In fact, networking isn't really about getting a job. It's about using shared interests to develop and maintain mutually beneficial relationships. Then, if you lose your job, these contacts will be there to help. Done right, Networking is a lifelong evolving process that you should do frequently, if not daily. It's as natural as eating and sleeping. Whenever you talk with others and seek their opinions to make an informed decision, even if it's just to find a good restaurant, movie, or electrician, you're networking. Of course, this definition raises red flags for many shy people. But if you understand your personality type and your limitations, you can create a strategy that works for you, says Bill.
Part 4. As hundreds of trade ministers and officials are on their way to Cancun to open on Wednesday, the 10th of September, the fifth ministerial meeting of the World Trade Organization, WTO, the world's largest trade union group, has condemned member states of the WTO for deliberately keeping the central item of workers' rights off the organization's agenda. In a new report launched today, the Brussels-based International Confederation of Free Trade Unions, ICFTU, says that the negative downward spiral of low labor standards will continue as governments compete against each other for foreign investment by offering cheaper labor, tax breaks, and other concessions. It accuses WTO member countries of refusing to even allow WTO discussion of pressing social problems relating to globalization. The 25-page report on export processing zones describes the poverty wages and appalling working conditions of most of the world's 43 million EPZ workers, and calls on the World Trade Body to renew and demonstrate its commitment to uphold core labor standards. The Cancun meeting, according to the ICFTU, must take a decision that human rights, including fundamental workers' rights, take priority over trade rules, and should start working on this without delay. The report is accompanied by exclusive new video footage from EPZs in the Dominican Republic, Honduras, and the Philippines, which graphically demonstrates how workers are exploited, and how workers trying to organize trade unions are often sacked or even violently assaulted by thugs hired by employers. For the ICFTU, EPZs are an international symbol of the exploitative nature of today's globalization, highlighting broader concerns about the negative impact of WTO rules on workers in the private and public sectors worldwide. By its very nature, EPZ investment is precarious and likely to leave the country at a moment's notice if a cheaper, more compliant workforce is on offer somewhere else, the report notes. It also exposes the myth that EPZs contribute to real economic development, with workers living in slummed conditions and frequently deprived of health care, education for their children, and even basic public services, while EPZ companies pay no taxes. ICFTU General Secretary Guy Ryder, leading a 150-strong international trade union delegation to the talks, will address a press conference today in Cancun. According to Ryder, globalization has the potential to bring prosperity to people across the world, but today's crude free market globalization is pushing standards down and leading to massive exploitation. The absence of effective multilateral trade roles to support the standards set by the International Labor Organization cannot be allowed to continue, yet governments are refusing to even allow the WTO and the ILO to work together on the problem. The survey notes that the number of EPZs has grown from 79 in 1975 to 3,000 in 2002, and the number of countries with one or more EPZs has gone from 25 to 116 in the same period. Many developing countries, especially in Central America and in Asia, are losing investment to China's economic zones, where independent unions are ruthlessly repressed by the state and workers toil for as little as $1.20 US a day. One of the more dramatic examples in the report concerns the pregnancy tests imposed by some employers in the Maquilas, EPZs, of Mexico. In factories located along the U.S. border, women are often subjected to humiliating physical examinations to prove that they are not pregnant. While employers in the Philippines have forced their workforce to take amphetamines to meet tight production deadlines imposed by well-known multinational clothing and footwear brands. The ICFTU's investigations have also detailed cases of physical violence in the largest EPZ employer in the Dominican Republic, Grupo M, which supplies major international clothing brands and is expected to soon receive a $23 million U.S. dollar loan from the World Bank's International Finance Corporation. Workers who try to join a union in one of Grupo M's factories report beatings and illegal detentions by company-sponsored thugs inside the factory, which is known for its anti-union attitude.
Sample Test 2.
Part 1. A. Police are awaiting the results from medical experts before determining if anyone was responsible for the death of a 22-year-old man after he was detained in a shoplifting incident. Evan Larson was in an electronics store when store employees said they caught him stealing an expensive projector unit. A customer and the employees detained Larson, who became violent and combative, according to police. At some point in the fight, he lost consciousness. A day later, he was taken off life support and died. The incident brings to light a difficult subject for businesses to deal with. What do you do when you catch someone stealing? A local labor and employment lawyer says most retail businesses have learned that it's just not worth it to fight with a thief or robber. A criminal lawyer says the law as it relates to citizens' arrest is pretty clear. You must find someone, that is, seeing them, committing an offense. Then you are allowed to use a reasonable amount of force to complete that arrest. That doesn't mean you can do anything and everything to stop him from getting away, he said. It comes down to what is reasonable force. But if a shoplifter hasn't left the premises, it becomes even more complicated. A store owner must rely on reasonable and probable grounds that he was going to commit an offense. Simply walking out of a store with something in your pocket is not necessarily theft if it wasn't intended. An arrest requires evidence that the person intended to steal.
B. 1. Dave said he might not be able to make the meeting next week. 2. No sooner had Mary got home than her brother called. 3. Carl's participation in the swim meet is still up in the air. 4. I saw Betty off and on all summer till she flew to New York. 5. The high school students held a dance to raise funds for their trip. 6. The store advertised 50% off all discontinued items. 7. George moved into town because the long commute was getting to him. 8. Joe and Liz have had an on-again, off-again relationship for years. 9. Mike at last seems to be feeling his age. 10. Linda has really painted herself into a corner this time.
Part 2. A few years ago, a lone American campaigner wrote a book in which he set out the main points of his fascinating idea to abolish television. His book, Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television, is an American cult bestseller, and after 8 editions, is still generating concern and hot debate in the United States. Jerry Mander, a former advertising expert, is convinced that for the sake of our freedom and mental and physical health, we should learn to live without television. Through his advertising background, Mander is aware of how much of television is concerned with advertising. He sees the planting of values for a profit as a deep, profound, and disturbing act by the few against many for a trivial purpose. And, even without commercials, he sees TV as disturbing because it crams people's heads with images which alter the way they feel and behave. Pictures formed by 300,000 tiny dancing dots altering 30 times per second bombard their eyes as people scan the images 10 times a second. But, argues Mander, even if you reject or doubt what you see consciously, it is too late. The crucial messages have gone home. He further argues that TV is a deafening experience as it is restricted to just two senses, sight and sound. Perception is dulled and flattened, says Mander, when you can't feel and smell and totally experience an event. People are just sitting passively for up to 4 hours a night, watching a flickering screen and listening to artificial sound. No culture in history has spent such an enormous amount of time looking at artificial light, says Mander. And another worrying fact is that prolonged exposure to artificial light alters human cells, which is why it is being used for certain medical treatment. Researchers do not know if lifelong TV exposure is a physical risk or not, but, as Mander would argue, why run the risk? It is important that people get up now and switch off before the harm is done.
Part 3, Passage 1. Children naturally trust adults and are taught to respect authority figures. But that trust and respect can leave them vulnerable to someone wanting to take advantage of them. Children should be taught that not all adults are to be trusted, that children have the right to question what adults do with them, and that sometimes adults do bad things. Establishing good communication with your children so they feel free to discuss matters that concern them is a vital first step towards dealing with potential child abuse. Child abusers fear being caught. They are less likely to target a child who has parents actively interested in their children's welfare. Well, talk to your children every day about their activities, feelings, and concerns. Tell your children that no one has the right to touch his or her bodies, and that if anyone tries to touch them, they can say no, and they should tell you about it. Emphasize that they don't have to give a reason or explanation for saying no. Don't have secrets in your house, and encourage your children to tell you about secrets that worry them. Your children should be taught their home phone number and another number where someone could be reached in an emergency. Show them how to dial the 911 emergency number and explain they can call this number if they need help. Don't leave your children alone at home.
Passage 2. Nick sat in my classroom after school wanting help with a research essay that stood between him and graduation. An average student at a competitive Minnesota secondary school, he felt overmatched by the assignment. His green eyes pleaded with me, his English teacher, his hope. Many parents find themselves in the same position. A child feels lost with homework and turns to you for help. Not wanting the child to fail, and often desperately wanting him to succeed, some parents step in and take over. Parents often have pure intentions, but the result can be harmful. They're cheating their kids out of the very education they want them to get. Allowing children to master a skill, which often happens incrementally, results in lifelong gains. There are some ways to help without hurting. Be a model learner. If kids see you reading papers, magazines, or literature, they'll be more motivated to learn. I know a family that posts an article on the fridge, then makes it the topic of discussion at dinner. Ask what needs to be done, and look over completed assignments. This shows that you expect them to do the work and consider it important enough to review. To quote a teacher cliche, be a guide on the side, not a sage on the stage. For example, with an essay, ask your child to read it aloud instead of taking a red pen to it yourself, says Sylvia Seidel. You can suggest where to revise, but more importantly, kids will also hear mistakes as they read. If you're worried that your child's workload is too heavy or that he or she is falling behind, talk with the teacher about it rather than do the work yourself.
Passage 3. Harvard University is one of America's 100 best places to work if you're a mom, Working Mother magazine announced September 23rd in its annual 100 Best Companies for Working Mothers issue. While this distinction may come as no surprise to the thousands of employee parents who take advantage of Harvard's family-friendly policies and generous benefits packages, it is nonetheless a powerful testament to the university's determination to be a competitive, compassionate employer for women, parents, and all employees. Working Mother rates companies on 6 qualities: flexibility, representation of women, particularly in upper management, childcare, advancement of women, family-friendly corporate culture, and leave for new parents. This year, editors gave particular weight to 3 issues: flexible scheduling, advancement of women, and childcare options. Harvard excels in all the areas the magazine deems important. Women comprise 54% of the university's workforce, and 30.5% of faculty are women. Women are also well represented in the university's highest positions. Harvard has 3 female deans. 3 of 5 vice presidents are women, and there are 13 women among the 37 people on the university's governing boards. Harvard also stands out in flexible scheduling, family leave, and childcare options. Harvard has been a leader in providing full benefits for those who work half-time or more, backup care for children and elders, parental leave for not only birth mothers, but also birth fathers and adoptive parents, and scholarship assistance for childcare. Work-life benefits continue to rise despite the challenging economy, as companies respond to pressure from young people of both sexes. Work-life benefits are here to stay.
Part 4. My daughter Sydney and I were in a rental car the size of a Pepsi can heading from Los Angeles to the Grand Canyon when it happened. We had driven nearly 8 hours without incident. The night was foggy, misty, and still. It was just as I had imagined Arizona nights to be when I originally planned the trip. We were only 20 minutes from our hotel when I hit the deer. The deer appeared like a phantom in the moonlight. After a brake lock skid of about 30 meters, and after I began breathing again, from the back seat I heard Sydney ask, "What happened?" Those were the first words I'd heard her speak in about 4 hours. Our trip took place at the end of Sydney's winter holiday, which marks the halfway point of the school year. We hadn't taken a road trip like this for over 2 years, and it would probably be our final vacation together, just Papa and daughter, before I got remarried. The last time we hit the open road, Sydney was 9 and talked on endlessly about school, movies, and books. Now she was almost 12 and hesitant about divulging her thoughts. She still talks for hours, but not to me. She talks to her friends, and mostly on the internet. So after loading up the car, she jumped in the back seat, put on her headphones, and buried her head in a book about Buffy the Vampire Slayer. "Here we go," I said, but she didn't hear a word from her nest in the back seat. Her cache of CDs held her attention. Even when we stopped for lunch at Lake Havasu to see the London Bridge, she was quiet. I explained how the magnificent stone bridge that used to span London's Thames River had made its way to western Arizona, but she didn't seem to care. She would have walked right out of her skin just to be with her friends. Back on the road, I often glanced in my rearview mirror to steal a look at her silently singing or pondering her book. When she caught me looking, she'd mouth, "What?" The chasm separating the front and back seats of the car seemed as broad as the Grand Canyon. I turned onto Arizona 64, a smooth stretch of highway leading straight to the hotel. Occasionally, the moon and a handful of stars shone through the clouds. My senses felt heightened with the surrounding beauty. I slowed the car. And then from that dark thicket, the deer leaped into the light, heading straight for our car. The impact woke Sid. The car idled as we searched the road and the woods for any sign of the deer, but nothing moved in the darkness. I must have mumbled over and over something about what to do now, because Sid asked, "Are you more concerned for the deer or the car?" I looked in the mirror and saw her face. It was an honest question. "The deer," I replied, realizing that I had declined the rental company insurance. If the car was still running, and amazingly it was, and neither one of us was hurt, then my thoughts were for the deer. Sid must have sensed me slipping away in my head. I was brought back to the moment, however, by the sensation of her hand reaching out of the darkness, stretching across the wide depths of our tiny car, and squeezing my shoulder. It took a full hour for me to drive the last several kilometers, but her hand stayed with me until we arrived at the hotel.